From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. What would you do to get into the college of your dreams? Or more accurately, what would your parents do? Would they hire someone to take admissions tests for you? Photoshop your face onto the body of an athlete? Bribe a coach? Well, that's what the Justice Department charged 50 people with yesterday in the nation's largest ever college admissions indictments. People have been trying to game the system for a long time, so in a sense, this really isn't anything new. Rather, maybe it's a new window into the lengths the ultra-privileged will go to for a name-brand degree. The lure of the higher ed label and what it's costing the rest of us. This hour on Point, the college cheating scandal, and you can join us. What does this case say about the state of college admissions, about the lengths people are willing to go to for that elite brand name school? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, the indictments came down in several district courts, including in California, Texas, Maryland, New York, Nevada, and Massachusetts. The announcement was made yesterday by U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling in Boston. Max Larkin is a reporter with WBUR's education team, Edify, and he joins us now. He covered the story yesterday. Max, it's good to see you.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, tell us a bit more about specifically what were the charges in this case.
There were a host of charges laid out by the U.S. attorney. The scam's purported ringleader, a man named Rick Singer, was charged with racketeering conspiracy, money laundering conspiracy, and obstruction of justice. He pled guilty. Then dozens of people, mostly parents and coaches, were charged with wire fraud and mail fraud and the conspiracy to commit it. In short, I think the U.S. attorney revealed a vast conspiracy to get the children of the people Singer called the wealthiest families in the United States to get them into the colleges of their choice using bribes and often deception.
And just to clarify one thing here, Max, so I mean, it's been called the, sort of a Hollywood scandal because there are some very A-list actors and actresses' names on the list of indictments here. But we're also talking about CEOs and hedge fund managers, just the elite of America, more broadly speaking.
That's right. I think the celebrity involvement probably does account for the hot interest that the story is getting today. You had actress Lori Loughlin, who became known to America as Aunt Becky on Full House, and her husband, who's a fashion designer. They're alleged to have pretended their daughter's road crew to get them into the University of Southern California, up to the point of photographing them on those ergometers, the rowing machines. They also gave Singer, the ringleader, $500,000, allegedly, and then $50,000 was diverted to USC's athletic program. You also had Felicity Huffman, who was nominated for an Oscar. She was arrested for spending $15,000 to guarantee that her daughter got an SAT score north of 1,400 points. And that was by means of a proctor in Singer's employ correcting some of her answers. So there's some really big names in this case, and it's a revealing window, as you said.
And the specificity of the things they were doing, I mean, how was this scheme pulled off?
Well, as the attorney laid it out, Singer's firm was engaged in two different types of fraud. First, they would falsely inflate students' SAT scores or ACT scores, often by bribing a proctor and finding some way to adjust their answers or have someone else entirely take the test. And then second, they would falsify entire athletic backgrounds for students to get them recruited as athletes at colleges in sports they didn't necessarily play well or play at all in many cases.
Wow. And you were saying how much some of these celebrities had spent. So how expensive was it? How expensive was this operation?
The SAT operation was the cheaper of the two, but it was remarkably expensive, between $15,000 and $75,000, with five-figure bribes going out to people who were supposed to supervise the test, honestly. But much of that money seemed to flow to Singer as well. And then the athletic version could be a lot more expensive. That sometimes ran into the six figures. And the charging documents say that over the 6 or 7 years of the scheme, Singer gathered and sent $25 million in bribes to college coaches.
Wow, so a sizable amount.
Yeah.
Okay, so how long was this going on?
Well, I think this is interesting. According to the charging documents, the full conspiracy started around 2011 and carried on until nearly the present day, until last month, actually. And on a call last summer, Singer said that over time he had gotten 761 students into college using these means. But there's an interesting remark in the documents, Meghna. At one point, Singer says the test cheating part of the scheme hadn't failed in, quote, 20-odd years. So there's a possibility that he'd been doing that part of the operation for quite a bit longer.
Okay. Now, Max, we talked for a second there about the big name Hollywood celebrities involved in the scandal or implicated in the scandal. Let's just circle back to that question, though, because there's also a number of people in finance and tech, right?
Yep. We've got a venture capitalist out in California with close ties to Northeastern. And there's a remarkable case of Bill McGlashan, who had made his name as a leading voice for ethical investing in Silicon Valley. And he had Singer put together a fake athletic profile to portray his son as a kicker in football, including apparently by use of Photoshop. And I think, Meghna, McGlashan has the key line of the entire charging documents. He was recorded saying in response to Singer's pitch to put together this profile, "Pretty funny. The way the world works these days is unbelievable."
Yeah, I suppose he's not laughing now. But Max, so let's take a step back here. I mean, do the schools themselves share some of the blame with this?
I think it's a big question. The U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling was very clear that schools are not being charged here, that individual employees, mostly of the athletic departments, were taking bribes and not disclosing them to the administration. So you have the soccer coach at Yale, a tennis coach at the University of Texas, and then coaches and an administrator at USC. I think it's telling how USC reacted, though. They fired those people, including a legendary water polo coach, and they faulted those individuals for kind of concealing their actions, and they clarified that, you know, they didn't feel like they were a part of the scandal or they were witting participants in this deception.
Okay. So really, I mean, I guess the question that we want to dig into this hour, Max, is what does this actually say about the competition for seats at elite colleges in America?
I think it says that competition is as ferocious as it's ever been, Meghna, and it clearly favors the rich. I spoke to a woman, Rachel Rubin. She studied college admissions as a graduate student at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. Now she runs a college counseling firm in Chestnut Hill outside of Boston. She said she sees this all the time. Wealthy parents who are determined to see students placed in the colleges of their dreams, colleges with name brands. And she says the wealthier ones are willing to go to extraordinary lengths.
The name of the university is very much a prestige factor for so many people that they'll do anything to get that prestige. You know, how many Louis Vuitton bags can you have and what is that worth in comparison to getting a Harvard degree?
So Ruben, Meghna, and other college counselors I spoke to yesterday, who are kind of an independent practice, said that unfortunately they were less surprised that this kind of behavior was going on and more surprised that it hasn't been exposed in the past, she said, and others said this is kind of the tip of the iceberg. She said the whole business, her business, is full of ethical challenges like this. Parents often want her to write essays and make connections with administrators. She draws the line there, says she won't do it, but she says clearly other admissions coaches don't have the same compunction. But I just one last thing. She also said she doesn't think this should discourage people from having some hope that of meritocracy in this system, that this wouldn't affect everybody's experience in college admissions.
Okay, so that's an interesting and important point, but it sort of gets me to my last question for you, Max, here. And, I mean, in this case, we're talking about allegations of bribery and fraud, right? So these are things that are being brought to a federal court. But really, I mean, how different is this from the things that families and, you know, the wealthy families of America already do to win admissions for their kids in these colleges?
Yeah, and I think that's a really fuzzy line, Meghna. I mean, as we saw in the Harvard admissions case in last fall, there's a lot of influence that wealth can buy you in a college admissions process. And Rick Singer, the ringleader here, I think has the best metaphor. He said you can get into college by the front door. That's applying on your own, trying your hardest, maybe with help from a tutor, or maybe not. Then there's the back door. You can give a lot of money to the school and hope that your child's application will get a second look. That's the kind of thing that Harvard shed a little light on in the discrimination trial. They said, you know, and we were revisiting the news that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, got into Harvard after his father gave the school a $2.5 million gift. Singer said, this is the side door. You know, I can guarantee you a seat for a fraction of the investment. And it worked for a while. And now... now they're all paying the price.
Well, that's Max Larkin. He's a reporter for Edify. That's WBUR's education news team here. Max, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
All right, so let's turn now to Daniel Golden. He joins us in the studio as well. He's senior editor at ProPublica. In 2004, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his Wall Street Journal series on elite college admissions. And he's also author of The Price of Admission, How America's Ruling Class Buys Its Way into Elite Colleges and Who Gets Left Outside. Daniel Golden, it's great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Pick up where Max left off here. I mean, you've been following college admissions for years now. I mean, how different was what the U.S. attorney announced yesterday from patterns of behavior you've seen before?
Well, I'd say it's kind of logical but extreme outer edge outgrowth of what you typically see. I mean, typically, as you described, somebody who's very wealthy may make a large gift to a university around the time that their child is applying or has just been accepted. Now, that goes to the institution as a whole. In this case, the bribes went to individual people like the college coaches. Now, you could say that's worse. I think from a criminal point of view, it appears to be worse. Whether it's morally worse is a difficult thing to judge. The other point I'd make is you were discussing whether the colleges are to blame. And in the narrow sense, in this case, they appear to have been deceived. The institutions didn't know this was going on.
Well, in fact, I think the U.S. attorney said that they view the colleges themselves as having been victims of this.
Yeah, I wouldn't quite go that far. In my view, they bear sort of broader responsibility for developing and perpetuating a fundamentally unfair system that these families and this private college counselor took advantage of. But if the system didn't have these vulnerabilities, then they couldn't have been exploited.
Okay, so we have about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break here. What are one of the vulnerabilities that were being exploited here? I think the use of or the bribing of coaches in particular gives us an insight into the leg up that athletes might get in admissions.
Yeah, and athletes get a leg up not just in widely played sports like football and basketball, but in these niche sports like crew or sailing. It would probably be a lot tougher to pretend that your kid was a great football player in high school because people would know that. You know, but it's easy. The little-known sports get a big admissions advantage, partly because colleges want the fundraising associated with them. But is that really warranted?
Well, Daniel Golden, hang on here for just a second. We are talking about the massive college admissions scandal that was revealed by U.S. attorneys yesterday. And we want to know what you think. Are you surprised or maybe not that wealthy parents would go to these lengths, including fraud and bribery, to get their kids into America's elite colleges? And why would they do it, especially for families that already have the privilege, the money, and the networks? Does getting into those colleges really make a difference in their kids' lives, or are they after something else? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the massive college admissions scandal that was revealed yesterday by U.S. attorneys in Boston and how allegedly very rich families in America, some high-profile Hollywood celebrities, folks from finance and tech, really gamed the system, including bribing coaches, paying people to take tests, college admission tests for their kids, and what that says about the lengths people will go to get into America's elite universities. Before the break, we were talking about how some of these families pretended or photoshopped faces of their kids onto the bodies of athletes because athletes can get a leg up in college admissions. On that point, here's FBI Special Agent Joseph Bonavolanta yesterday talking about the nature of the corruption in yesterday's press conference.
Evidence we've obtained shows that trusted coaches and administrators manipulated the systems their universities had in place to accommodate students with fake athletic credentials, some of whom did not even play the sports they were recruited to play. It's a sham that strikes at the core of the college admissions process at universities across the country. But today's arrests should be a warning to others. You can't pay to play. You can't lie and cheat to get ahead because you will get caught.
That's FBI Special Agent Joseph Bonavolanta saying, you can't pay to play. You will get caught. Well, Andrew Lelling, the U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts, addressed the college admissions scam yesterday. And here's what he said about the limits of pay to play.
We're not talking about donating a building so that a school's more likely to take your son or daughter. We're talking about deception and fraud. Fake test scores, fake athletic credentials, fake photographs, bribed college officials.
That's U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling. Joining us again in the studio is Daniel Golden. He's author of The Price of Admission, How America's Ruling Class Buys Its Way Into Elite Colleges and Who Gets Left Outside. And Dan Golden, I want you to reflect with me on what Andrew Lelling said here, because I think this is a quote that's really drawn a lot of people's attention. Sure, in the eyes of the criminal justice system, there are bright lines around fraud and bribery. But morally, what is the difference between what these families are alleged to have done and the very common practice of buying a building on a campus, getting your family's name on it, and, you know, greasing the wheels to get your kids into that school?
Well, I'm not sure there's a big difference morally. And also, even legally, if you give a building with the, express purpose of getting your child admitted, should you really be able to get a tax donation for making that gift? Because is it really a charitable gift or is it a straightforward business transaction? So there may be legal issues with that.
But schools will, I should say, to be fair, schools will vehemently deny that purchasing a building factors in, you know, massively into getting a kid into school.
Well, schools have long submerged this entire aspect of college admissions. I mean, if you go to college night, they'll tell you that the main reasons to get ways to get into college are grades and test scores and recommendations and things like that. They won't say, oh, if your parent is prepared to make a large donation, you go to the head of the line here. So, schools are very concerned with their image. But the other point I was going to make was that, as I was saying before, somebody being able to donate a building to get a kid in is part of what's a very unfair system that was exploited here. I mean, this scheme was designed to take advantage of the loopholes that favor the rich, the preferences in admissions for niche sports only played by the upper crust, the manipulating of learning disabilities to get extra time and less supervision in tests so that the proctor can change the grades, the use of private college counselors who aren't available to most kids, most of whom just have an overburdened guidance counselor at their public high school has hundreds of other kids to try and help. So, it's an entire system that's unfair and tilted, and this is kind of the logical consequence.
Talk to me more about the aspect of the cheating on the test, on the hiring of people to take tests for their kids. I mean, that to me, that's something that was actually quite new. Maybe it's been going on. I don't know. But one would presume, and I'll read a statement from the College Board here in just a second, that, I mean, they take your fingerprint. It's a very, secure environment. Were you surprised that, like, they were able to pull that off?
I was surprised. I mean, I'm not intimately familiar with the security arrangements at these tests, but from reading the complaint, it appears that by claiming a disability and getting extra time, you not only have an opportunity to do better on the test, which is why I thought some people did it, but also it reduces the amount of security and supervision so that there's basically one administrator there who apparently can be bribed. So that's a gap. Now, it's long been pointed out that wealthy families seek this advantage for their kids, but primarily I thought just to get them more time or a chance to do better, not to have somebody else take the test.
In someone else entirely.
And the sad part here also is that most of the kids apparently weren't aware that this was going on. They were taking the test themselves. They thought they were doing great. They didn't realize that it was all a setup by their own parents.
Yeah. Well, we have a comment coming in on Twitter about this exact issue. A.E. Walsh says, I hope that kids who really do need testing accommodations won't have to jump through more hoops as a result of this investigation. And as promised, we have a statement here from the College Board specifically. And they said the arrests resulting from an investigation conducted by the U.S. Attorney's Office in Massachusetts send a clear message that those who facilitate cheating on the SAT, regardless of their income or status, will be held accountable. The College Board has a comprehensive, robust approach to combat cheating, and we work closely with law enforcement as part of those efforts. We will always take all necessary steps to ensure a level playing field for the overwhelming majority of test takers who are honest and play by the rules. That's a statement from the College Board. Let's go to the phones really quickly. Let's go to Diane, who's calling from York, Maine. Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, I am a professor at a university in Boston, and I just want to share that I think this behavior on the part of parents is being reflected in what we're seeing in students. Students have an incredible entitled behavior, and I think that it comes from this kind of behavior on the part of the parents. They think, I say to students, you know, you have to earn a degree, and their attitude is, you owe this to me because I'm paying this tuition. So I think that we're creating a generation of people that are even more entitled based on this behavior, particularly with these very elite, wealthy families.
Well, Diane, thank you for your call. Daniel Golden, what do you think about that? Because I am curious about whether or not this is the natural, even if, you know, criminal and distasteful outgrowth of the commodification of these, you know, elite degrees.
Well, as we mentioned before, that the students weren't necessarily aware of what their parents were doing. So I'm not sure we can, in this particular case, attribute it to a kind of, you know, arrogance on the part of the kids. Now,
or the parents, as Diane also pointed out.
Yeah. Now, you know, I just don't know enough about modern attitudes of parents, but certainly I've seen this often in college admissions, a kind of air of entitlement among the wealthy and the privileged, and where they'll go to any lengths to get a boost for their kids and to get them into some elite university. And you often wonder why, because after all, at this level of income, the kids are probably looking forward to financial security no matter what college they go to. So it doesn't seem like it could be strictly for wealth. It has to be for status, for prestige, for the imprimatur of success. And often you'll see that the first generation to be successful in a family, the original entrepreneur, did not go to one of these elite schools or graduate mm-hmm. from them. So maybe that's the one thing they kind of miss. You know, they say, well, I made a lot of money, I built up my business, but my family isn't really in the inner circle yet. And so it becomes a dream for their kids and their grandkids to go to the Ivy League or Stanford or some brand name college.
But explore this with me a little bit more, Dan Golden. I know you really know about the admissions practices of the university, but bear with me here, because this is really one of the questions that has captivated me about this case is, as you exactly point out, we are talking about people whose children, you know, short of a disaster, will never suffer for a day in their lives. They will never be lacking in money. By virtue of where they are in American society, they have vast built-in influential networks. They will have all of the advantages, educational or not, that come with being an elite in America. They have all of the things, save for maybe the actual educational experience, that one might gather from going to a place like Stanford or USC or Yale. And yet they're fighting so hard to get in. I mean, what is it other than the name brand? I just don't know.
I mean, it's a good question. I think we'd have to be psychologists to really understand. I mean, my sense would be maybe they feel like outsiders, even though they made it big financially, and that this is a way of getting to the inside in America. And there is some reality to that that isn't necessarily measured financially. But, you know, if you look at the hallways of power, you know, the members of the Senate, the clerks in the Supreme Court, people like that often do have degrees from elite universities. And to the extent that there is a kind of inner establishment or club in America, these schools are still one of the gateways. And you can't measure it in dollars, but in a kind of feeling, I'm there. I've made it. Yeah. I'm in the highest place I can be in our society. Look who's around me. Maybe that's what they want and that's what they miss.
It's not good enough to be on Full House, I guess. Let's go back to the phone. Let's go to Nancy, who's calling from Frankfort, Kentucky. Nancy, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm just really concerned about that no one is talking about the kind of damage it's going to do psychologically to all these students, whether it be the ones that were initially involved and not knowingly what their parents must think of them, to their self-image. It's just a lifetime damage to their psyche, I think. Mm. And no one's talking about that.
Yeah. Nancy, thank you for your call. Dan Golden, go ahead.
I'd say that is a concern, and we should have some empathy for these students with this, as you say, who are suddenly finding out that they didn't do as well as they thought. I'd point out that, again, that's different in degree, but maybe not in kind, from how many students feel who get in after their parents make a huge donation. and they're never quite sure if they got in on their own merit or because of the parents' wealth. It's an anxiety or an insecurity that they would have there, and it, in this case, would be even more magnified.
Yeah.
Well, I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. So Daniel Golden, hang on here for just a second. Joining us now from Redwood City, California, is John Ryder. He's a former Stanford University admissions officer, and Stanford was one of the schools named in yesterday's complaint. He's recently retired as director of college counseling at San Francisco University High School. A private high school, and he's co-author of Admissions Matter, What Students and Parents Need to Know About Getting into College. John Ryder, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so you were a former admissions officer at Stanford University. Remind me, what dates you were admissions officer there? When did you leave Stanford?
I was there from 1985 to 2000.
Okay, so quite, but you were there for quite a bit of time. So
I was there a long time.
How surprised were you at the allegations in yesterday's complaint?
Well, I was surprised by one aspect, but not others. I had seen little bits and pieces of this kind of behavior during my tenure and actually afterwards. I knew about cheating on the SAT. I knew that coaches could get kids in. I certainly knew, I'm a fan of Dan Golden's book, and certainly, in fact, I'm a source in it, although unnamed, that you know, rich people could do things with college admissions that ordinary people couldn't. What I had not seen, and which did surprise me, was the scale and the comprehensiveness, that this was sort of like going to a casino, and you can play all different kinds of gambling games. You know, you can play roulette and blackjack and slot machines. It's all there, whatever you want to do. And so the breadth of this was rather startling.
Can I just jump in here, John Ryder, for a second? Because I want to ask you specifically about the purported ringleader of all of this, who was named in the indictment, Rick Singer. You know, he's the one who's been charged with racketeering conspiracy, money laundering conspiracy, obstruction of justice, the guy who apparently came up with this idea about how to game the system. Did you ever encounter him in your career?
I never met him. I've never seen him in action. But I had heard of him. And I had heard from when he was originally in Sacramento before he was in Southern California, and this is back in the 90s, that he was bragging in public very often that he could get kids into Stanford, that he had a special feel for Stanford and access to people at Stanford. That was clearly not true. No one in the admissions office had ever heard of him. He used the former president of Stanford and a member of the State Board of Education who had gone to Stanford, had 2 degrees from Stanford, as his buddy. And I instigated this through the admissions office, contacted these people and said, this guy is using your name, and I don't think you want to have your name used, because I don't think he's doing this in a legitimate way. And they both insisted, these two people, that they didn't want to be associated with him.
Well, John, jump in here? You say he was using the names of the former president of Stanford, but how was he using them?
He had a company called Five Star. You know, the new one is Edge, which is an interesting name in itself. And he had a mythical advisory board. You know, we all have fundraising letters from good organizations and, you know, famous people. Jimmy Carter is on the advisory board. You know, he's just there as a name. I doubt he does anything dramatic. And so he had made up this advisory board and put these people on it. And, you know, they didn't even know about it. And they didn't know anything about his work. And they didn't want to be. They're honorable people. They're people that I like. They wanted to get away from it.
So John Ryder.
He has a long history in California.
Okay, so this is.
I did not know about his more recent business. And although he had a lot of Bay Area clients, as you indicated in your intro, I didn't know any of them.
Yeah. Well, so John Ryder, this is absolutely fascinating that you're saying that Rick Singer, the man at the center of this alleged conspiracy, years ago was claiming that people like the president of Stanford University were on the advisory board, as you say, as you claim, a mythical advisory board for his former company, Five Star. Okay, wow, that's kind of incredible. But John, how is it that I mean, if this kind of stuff was known to be going on, I mean, you were an admissions officer in Stanford. How did the admissions office, you know, sort of protect against false or fraudulent behavior coming to the admissions office through applicants from students?
It's a very complicated process. And I wanted to comment because it came up earlier as to how they pulled this off. The process, because it's so large, depends on an enormous amount of trust. You have to trust your fellow admissions officers. You have to trust the coaches, which clearly failed in this case. But the coaches say, this kid is a place kicker. Well, you're not going to ask for a video of him kicking the ball. You're going to take the coach's word.
Right. John Ryder, stand by for a second because we just have to take a really quick break. Hang in here with me. And Daniel Golden, stand by as well. We are talking about that college admissions scandal revealed by a U.S. attorney yesterday and what it says about the lengths people will go to get their kids into elite colleges in America. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the nation's largest college admissions scandal thus far. And we're joined today by John Ryder. He is a former Stanford University admissions officer. He was there between 1985 and 2000. Recently retired as director of college counseling at San Francisco University High School, a private high school. Daniel Golden also joins us as well. He's senior editor at ProPublica and author of The Price of Admission, How America's Ruling Class Buys Its Way into Elite Colleges and Who Gets Left Outside. And Daniel Golden, let me turn here to you for a second, because before the break, we were hearing John Ryder talk about the fact that Rick Singer, who's at the center of this alleged conspiracy, was apparently known to some folks in the Bay Area of California for a while and was able to create a company with, in John Ryder's word, a mythical advisory board where he was claiming that the president of Stanford University was on that board and using that influence to perhaps help students gain admissions to colleges and universities. What's your reaction to that?
Well, it makes me think again about the pitfalls and risks of having private college counselors with independent businesses sort of going rogue as the intermediaries between the wealthy and the admissions offices. I mean, a guidance counselor at a public high school probably would not be able to, nor would even ever think of using some kind of mythical advisory board or fake elite people as references to try and get a kid in. So, but now the wealthy bypass those public guidance counselors and they go with these independent college counselors who, I'm sure some of them are very reputable, but clearly not all of them are.
Well, John Ryder, I mean, you were at Stanford, again, just to remind folks, between 1985 and 2000. But if I just may ask, I'm curious, when you and other folks at Stanford heard that Singer was operating in the Bay Area and making these fraudulent claims, you were telling us that that those high-level people at Stanford asked him to stop. But did anyone ever report him?
Who would you report him to? There was no indication. I had no knowledge that he was pulling any of the clearly illegal shenanigans that he's been doing more recently. All I knew was he was bragging.
Uh-huh.
As I told somebody else yesterday, he went from bragging to bribing. So I didn't know that he was doing anything illegal like this. And we were always very suspicious of any applicant who looked like they'd had contact with an independent counselor. Dan Golden's comments are, as your show is called, on point. And so if there was any indication that there was an independent counselor involved, we were very skittish. But the trouble is the files were sanitized, and you didn't know. So there was, I remember one occasion where I knew, because it was a local child that I had an indirect connection to, I knew she had used an independent counselor who was good, who was ethical. I didn't have a complaint with that person. But the application showed absolutely no evidence of it.
Right.
It was very well put together, and it was very convincing, and the kid got in. I don't think, again, anything immoral was done. I would have to differ a little bit with Dan, who I consider a friend, about where the moral line is. When his book came out, a woman I know who's an independent counselor had gone to Harvard on scholarship, and she objected to the book, although I liked it. And she said, all those rich people who gave money to Harvard provided scholarships so I could go there for nothing. And so the moral use or misuse of the donations is an interesting question. And to me, it's not quite as cut and dried as it's been portrayed.
Right.
Clearly what's been done in this case is illegal and way beyond the pale. And I think it's very different from somebody endowing a professorship or a scholarship or something.
Yeah.
They're actually doing something good with their money.
So, John Ryder, fair point, actually. And let me get Dan Golden to respond to that.
Yeah, I that is a good point, John. And I agree that, you know, universities may use their money for better purposes than the individual college coaches who got bribed use theirs. But at the same time, I think John would probably also agree that, you know, the donations should not be traded for admissions, and that you know, there's other ways for universities to raise money. Certainly, a place like Stanford, with, you know, with its array of excellent programs, could raise money on the basis of just being part of one of the world's great institutions and forwarding cutting edge research and thought, rather than taking a donation that where the implied a purpose was to let somebody in who was underqualified.
John Ryder, I mean, we could talk about this aspect of the story for quite a while. But John, if I may, I want to sort of mine your expertise here a little bit more, not only as a former Stanford admissions officer, but then after you left Stanford, you went to the San Francisco University High School. It's a private high school in San Francisco. Very elite, very high level, and you recently retired as the director of college counseling there. So I'm curious,
correct,
did you ever have families at this, you know, at the San Francisco University High School who, you know, who had a kid who, you know, maybe wasn't that academically accomplished and probably couldn't really cut it in, at one of these elite schools, and yet somehow got in through, you know, other mechanisms, as we're talking about, donations, fundraising, things like that. Did you see that happen?
Oh, of course. Of course. But to be fair, I also had families of that economic level who had wonderful kids who didn't need anything extra. Sometimes the parents went to those extra lengths. And sometimes the people thought they were better connected than they really were. And I remember asking a family, are you, I put it euphemistically, I said, are you involved alumni at your alma mater, which was an Ivy League school? And I remember the mom literally leaned in towards me and said, we're very involved. Well, it turned out they weren't quite as involved as they thought.
Right.
And it, so it doesn't always work. And Dan would accept that.
Well, John, forgive me for being a little bit more pointed, because you told our producer yesterday when she first contacted you, a particular story, which I'm hoping you'd be willing to tell today, about how there was a family at your high school where a kid was at the bottom of the class, and yet somehow he or she got into an elite Eastern university. How did that happen?
Yeah. That happened. Because, first of all, this is one of the wealthiest families in America. They're a nice family. The kid was not very interested in school. And he probably had ability, but he never used it. And the mother was both an alum of a college, and she was, I believe she was the chair of the Capital Campaign, which meant that she was helping them raise money, not just her own money, but helping them raise money with other people. And I ran into the dean of admissions at that school at a national admissions conference, and he was a good guy. We knew each other, just the way people know each other in the profession. And I said, you know, we've got this kid probably coming your way. And he just, he kind of grinned and he winced and kind of, you know, shrugged and said, yeah, I know. Well, we'll deal with it when the time comes. And they did. And they took the kid. I wasn't surprised. And, you know, I didn't make a fuss. He took a year off and did something worthwhile for himself and then went to the college. I want to stress it was not, by the way, an Ivy League college, just so anybody's, but it was a well-known, very reputable place. So, yeah, you know, but, you know, I was there 18 years, and that happened at that level once.
Once, okay.
So I think it's a mistake to see this as a kind of everybody is using this, to quote Rick Singer, to use, as everyone's using the side door or what he called the back door, which is giving a lot of money. It's not very common.
So
I would have a class of 100 kids a year, and maybe there were two that were at that level. So, it's real.
Yeah. Well, so John Ryder, I actually really appreciate you giving us that broader context, because it's actually quite shocking to hear that it even happened once. But if in your 18 years it wasn't a common occurrence, I'm glad to hear that. But Daniel Golden, this actually does get us to a part of this story where we should just explore the issue of fairness overall here, because I mean, we can talk about in all sorts of different ways that wealthy and influential families can pull levers in college admissions here. But at the base of it, one of the things that this new set of indictments from yesterday seems to point to is, you know, families were able to get, allegedly, kids who really weren't academically qualified or seemed to not be academically qualified for some of these schools. And factually speaking, they got in, meaning, you know, of the tens of thousands of applicants who are qualified, some kids didn't. And I think that's one of the things that people maybe perhaps are rightly angry about.
That's right. It's basically a zero-sum game. So if somebody gets in, somebody else isn't going to. And, of course, the chances of getting into these schools are, in some cases, very small. Some of the top schools admit less than 10% of their applicants. So these kids getting in are getting very coveted slots that, on the merits academically, they don't deserve. And, you know, John's, of course, right about how often the really blatant examples happen, but there is a kind of broader pattern of unfairness that benefits the wealthy. I mean, you know, alumni children are predominantly white and wealthy. They get a boost in admissions. Recruited athletes in a lot of the sports that came up in this case, crew, sailing, as well as, you know, fencing, equestrian events, things like that, are those sports are predominantly played at private high schools and elite suburban high schools by the white and affluent. And again, they get an edge as recruited athletes. There's known as development cases like Jared Kushner, you know, kids of people who have no connection to the university and are not alumni but just give money. There are, you know, a number of those cases, as we've discussed. So all these preferences add up together to an uneven playing field. And when you have that, then there's a greater opportunity for the kind of abuse we're talking about here.
Well, I want to get in a couple more calls before we run out of too much time here. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Michael, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to, first of all, this is a terrible scandal, obviously, but I'd like to recalibrate our outrage, if I may. First of all, there's a little hypocrisy because functionally illiterate kids get into school all the time because they can throw football. Now, I'd like to use a quick analogy. If you're waiting in line to get into a bar and somebody just walks up and pays off the bouncer and shows some fake ID, that's what this is, which is cheating and bribery. But what if you wait the hour and a half to get up to the front and you offer your $20 to get in and he says, I'm sorry, you can't get in because you're Chinese. And I think the outrage for what Harvard is accused of doing, it dwarfs what is probably commonplace. And that's just my comment.
Yeah. Michael, thank you for your call. So Michael's referring there to a federal case working its way through the court system right now, where a group of Asian American students are alleging that Harvard University has admissions practices that make it harder for Asian American students to be admitted there. So we've actually done shows about that, and go to onpointradio.org to link to it. But Dan Golden, do you have just a quick comment about that?
Well, my quick comment would be that in a way, these things are not unconnected, in that if these kids are getting in by virtue of the bribing and the low qualifications, as we discussed, they're pushing somebody out. And it may well be the kids who don't enjoy other preferences, like Asian American kids who don't get any of the preferences. They're not usually alumni children or they don't benefit from affirmative action. So this may be an additional barrier for them to overcome.
Yeah. Well, let's get one more call. Marfine is calling from Portland, Maine. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. So I'm the first one in my family, from a working class family, to get a college degree and law degree. So for me, this doesn't sit very well. So my question is, how do we unrig this whole system, which also creates a two-tier educational system that feeds income inequality?
Marfine, thank you for your call. And John Ryder, I'll give you the first shot at that. You know the system as well as anybody. How would you unrig it?
Oh, this is a wonderful question. I'm really glad he asked it. I have fantasized for years about what I would do if I were somehow the czar of the college admissions world, which there is no such person. And that's the first thing. It's terribly decentralized. Every college does exactly what it wants in its own interests, occasionally in the general interest, but mainly in its own interest. And that's as true at the elite schools as it is at state universities and small colleges that are struggling financially. So to get everybody on board, and there are rules. I mean, there's a national admissions organization, and they have rules that you're not supposed to bribe people, and, you know, they're all good rules. Here are a couple things that I would do, which would at least begin to address the inequality that Dan Golden correctly has identified goes through the system. And this is going to sound very radical, but in today's world, maybe it's not. First of all, I would abolish standardized testing. We're the only country in the world that has a standardized test that has nothing to do with high school curriculum,
mm-hmm.
although the College Board and ACT claim that it does, but it's not. They're independent of colleges.
Right.
We're the only country that seems to need this. It is clearly biased in favor of the wealthy. The system works that way.
Yeah.
Secondly, I would get rid of early decision and early action, which is another wrinkle which advantages the wealthy with good counselors, hopefully like me, say, you know, apply early because you get an advantage. The colleges are very clear that there's an advantage. Some colleges take 50% of their class early decision. I would do that.
Well, John, hang on for a second.
Limit the number of applications that you can make. The English do that. In Britain, you can only apply to 5 colleges.
Yeah.
You can't apply to both Oxford and Cambridge. Suppose we had a system where you could only apply, America's bigger than Britain, so 8, 10,
yeah.
Pick a number, I don't care.
John Ryder, I'm going to jump in here because we have 60 seconds left to go in this program, and I love those ideas. They are radical. Dan Golden, just your quick response. No, John wants to see a future where there's no standardized testing, no early admissions, and a limit to the number of places you can apply. It doesn't sound like it's feasible in the United States, but wild.
I'd maybe offer a few other things. I agree that standardized tests are not great, but I worry that in their absence, where everything's just based on grades from a school, those grades could be manipulated too. Just from our conversation, I'd say, what about, you know, licensing and regulating private college counselors? That would seem to be a first step that might address what's in this case. And then I would eliminate legacy preference, and I would eliminate preferences for sports that most kids don't get a chance to play.
Well, Dan Golden, senior editor at ProPublica and author of The Price of Admission, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And John Ryder, former Stanford admissions officer from 1985 to 2000. John Ryder, it was a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.